the Auckland Greens are thinking local and talking to the people with ideas for a better city and a richer future. Every Monday on Green Auckland.
Kia koutou, kia ora, and welcome again to Green Auckland, the program where we talk about events and issues of interest to people in New Zealand's biggest, boldest, and of course most beautiful city. My guest this week is a friend and a colleague, a fellow Green MP, Denise Roche. Denise is relatively new to Parliament. She just came in last year after the election, but she's certainly no stranger to politics nor to working with communities of interest. It's a long history doing that. Denise may be loosely described as an Aucklander, but she's actually a long-time citizen of the People's Republic of Waiheke Island. So welcome, Denise. Good to have you here, and thanks for sharing some of your time.
Thanks, Dave. It's a real delight to be here.
Good to have you. Denise, so yes, we haven't got time to hear your entire life story, but where did you start out? You've been in Auckland quite a long time and on the island a while, but...
Yeah, I was actually born in Helensville, so that's northwest Auckland, but grew up in the Waikato, which is where my parents are from. But I moved to Auckland, I think, for the first time when I was around about 16 or 17. So okay. All up, I've been living in Auckland, mostly in Auckland Central, which includes Waiheke, for about 26 years. So... you know, more than half my life. It's quite amazing to add it all up. Doesn't feel that long.
No, pretty much a native then, yes.
Yeah.
Cool.
Yeah.
You've had a lot of engagement with politics. Where did you start out? What was your first political act or your first involvement there?
Oh, well, I think probably I learnt politics at an early age because I'm one of nine children and I'm one of the younger ones. And so I learnt pretty early on that in order to offset the power at the top, you had to organise the ones at the bottom.
Sorry for your parents immediately, but carry on.
Well, you know, it's also where I learnt about factions. And we were quite a political family. Dad was a really strong Labor supporter. And Mum actually was a social credit supporter. So, there used to be some fairly fiery discussions around the dinner table. Good working class, you know, Michael Joseph Savage supporting family. And that's where I came from. Dad worked on the railways. Mum worked at the post office. So, yeah, it was just in my blood. And so very early on, I became a union organiser, and that was the start of an increasing politicisation, if you like. So I was 21 when I started out organising for the Northern Theatrical and Places of Amusement Workers Union.
Sorry, run that past me again. What a wonderful name.
It was. It did have a longer title than that, too. Northern Theatrical and Places of Amusement Workers Union. So it's front of house workers, cinema workers. It's where I met Matt McCartan. We started work on the same day. He was working with candy bar workers and I was working with the ushers and cashiers. And
that's quite young to go into working for a union, I would have thought. Was it... because you were closer to the age of the people you were organising for?
Yeah, well, I kind of slipped into it. I'd put myself back through high school because I didn't actually do very well at high school and was kind of a little bit rebellious. So I left without qualifications. But I went back to school as an adult student at Auckland Girls Grammar when I was 20 and got my UE and had to do all sorts of crazy jobs. You know, so I was cleaning at night. I was working in rest homes up until that point as well. But I got a job as a singing telegrammist. And yeah, I know. You know, I did literally sing for my supper. And I kind of got involved in the union through that. I also got a job as a cashier in a cinema. So I became a delegate. Then the organiser asked me if I'd like to apply for the job because she was leaving. And that's how it happened. My original intention was to get my qualifications and go to nursing school. But being a union organiser was a hell of a lot more fun, I think.
I dare say it would be, but not without its challenges as well. Yes.
No, but it didn't involve bedpans, so that was all right.
Okay, yes. Yes, only in the metaphoric sense, perhaps, sometimes, what flies around the place. And so you stayed with the union movement for a while, and did that progress to?
Yeah, I did. All up, it was about 16 years. So I went from theatrical workers to bank officers union, travelled for a while overseas and then came back and trained as a journalist and carried on working for unions after that as well. So I think my last job was with Service and Food Workers Union was 10 years ago. So 16 years in the union movement gave me a really good grounding. And in political issues for people who are really struggling to make ends meet, I worked mostly with low-paid workers. And I remember starting out in the 80s, you know, we didn't even have paid parental leave then. And working with women particularly and their issues, it was, it fitted well with the times as well, which was a real resurgence in feminism. So I feel really privileged and lucky to have had that kind of introduction.
Yes, though albeit it was a very tough time in the union movement too, wasn't it? The 80s and 90s, the unions come under serious attack and arguably... Yeah. Barely recovered even now, perhaps?
Definitely. I mean, I entered the union movement just at the end of the Muldoon era and the end of one of the first stints of voluntary unionism. And that was through the 80s. But by 91, when we had the mother of all budgets and a national...
Dear old Ruth, yes.
Yeah. The attacks on beneficiaries and at the same time we also had the Employment Contracts Act introduced, and what that did was that it broke the collectivism of bargaining. So you used to have an award, which meant that, you know, if you were a rest home worker in Auckland, you knew that you were on the same conditions as a rest home worker in the Waikato. Because it was all the same industry, and so they all had the same rights, and it was very good for particularly female dominated workforces. But with the introduction of workplace bargaining combined with voluntary unionism, we saw some major attacks on workers, and that's where you saw the erosion of penal rates. So up until that point, you could actually put yourself through university or high school working nights because you got shift allowances, and working weekends because you got time and a half. But that all went overnight almost, and it was really awful time for workers.
It certainly was, yeah. And as I said, certainly in terms of numbers and even in terms of influence, I think at one time the unions were very much around the table with governments of every stripe, and perhaps those days are not gone but much diminished maybe.
I think they have. I think the Council of Trade Unions still steps up to negotiate with the government, but we're seeing attacks now as well. We've got some legislation that the government is wanting to push through for state service workers, which will basically say that the government will set the bargaining framework, which is a breach of what we've got in terms of our industrial relations law. And they're also trying to do that with the local government reforms around wages and conditions. So it's pretty scary times for the public sector. In the private sector, they're also looking at reforms around union rights. So where we have managed to make advances for workers, I'm thinking particularly the Engineers Union, Maritime Workers Union, all those very strong unions, we're now seeing a pushback from the government to try and break some of their strength. So they're wanting to really undermine union rights and law. Mm-hmm. And that'll play out over the next few months.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so a busy time ahead indeed.
Yeah, there is.
So very much involved in union movement, union work. Then you've got a fairly big chunk of local body engagement on your CV as well. Where did that come from?
Around about 15 years ago, I moved to Waiheke Island, as you said, the People's Republic of Waiheke, a feisty and self-sufficient community. And currently there's around about 8,000 people living there, but it goes up to about 30,000 over the peak period. So I was really lucky to land a job with the Waste Resource Trust on Waiheke, which was we'd set up our own recycling collection, and they were in charge of the waste collection as well. But in order to reduce the amount of waste that we were creating, we need to get people to recycle more. So I was taken on as an educator, and I worked with the community and various other community groups and businesses and the schools to develop really good recycling programs and get people into it. So I did that for 7 years and became fairly widely known as Denise the Rubbish Lady. And we set up Junk to Funk, which was sort of like one of the biggest events on the island, where we got all the schools and, you know, all the arts community working to create wearable, wonderful wearable things out of the waste stream. And all the businesses came on board. I think our first one, we had about $5,000 worth of cash prizes. And about, I think we had something like 271 people participating in the show. So
extraordinary.
It was extraordinary. So so that carries on to even now. But around about 2004, I decided to get more active politically, and I stood for council in 2007, and defeated the sitting councillor who'd been there for the councillor for 9 years, and I won by 11 votes.
Goodness.
Yeah, I was called Landslide Roach for the next 3 years.
Massive win indeed, yeah.
Yeah.
It sounds like you're pretty good at stitching together different communities of interest. I mean, maybe was that something you learned in the union? I know to get a community activity event and have that much, for it to survive that long, you must be pretty good at stitching together groups and interests and individuals and businesses and all of those things. Where's that talent come from?
You know, it probably comes back to my family and organising those other 8 siblings. I think it's a skill that you develop, certainly in the working class and certainly with Māori families. You develop a sense of the collective rather than just the individual. And so you learn pretty early on your place in the group. My dad, for example, he never ever talked about himself as I. He always talked about we. Part of the problem was that he was from a family of 16 kids, and also he was an identical twin. So he, him and his twin were close their entire lives. So, so he had a problem about identifying himself as an individual. And I think I grew up in a time where the collective was more important than the individuals, and that's kind of my philosophy, I think, when it comes to politics as well, that a politician, whether you're in council or in your community or you're working for a community group or if you're an MP, you are essentially an advocate for a wider group. And if you lose hold of that, then you have the you're in danger of becoming isolated and off track. So, yeah, it's something I delight in. I think being involved in a group and stitching people together, if you like, from all different areas, gives you a much broader sense of the world. And I'd hate to become narrow-minded.
Yeah, no danger of that by the sound of it. Yeah. So, having managed to get yourself as a politician on a landslide, what then kept you busy on council? What were some of the issues over those years?
Oh, gosh, there were quite a lot. One of the most distressing ones for me, to set the scene, I mean, it was a major advance and victory for me and the people I represent to become a councillor.
Yes, that's no small thing to actually unseat a sitting person. It's quite tricky often, yeah.
Yeah, So that was, you know, fantastic. The bad news was that John Banks was the mayor, and the majority of councillors in council were from the right-wing Citizens and Ratepayers organisation, political party, basically. And some of those people have since gone on to become MPs as well, people like Sam Lotoinga and Paul Goldsmith, and they were councillors at the time, at the same time as me. So it was, and it was really, really unpleasant. Their kaupapa, if you like, was to focus on roads, rates, rubbish, and the social policies that had been developed and the social actions that were occurring in communities being funded by councils, they took a massive hit. I think that one of the hardest things for me was on Waiheke. I had a conflict of interest over the waste contract. We lost our community contract for our community-owned company, and it went to an international company who've introduced wheelie bins. So all of the 7 years of work that I did encouraging people to sort at source to create a high-quality recycling product, all that's gone out the window. And as of, I think, June this year, we've basically slid backwards in terms of what we're producing in rubbish. So we're basically producing, we're producing the same amount of rubbish that we produced in 2001. And, you know, we'd declined rapidly over those 7 years that, and well, yeah, the 7 years that I'd worked there. So that was awful. I guess the other thing that really kept me busy at the time was the government's legislation to force the super city on us. And that was, yeah, that was a huge amount of work for people in Auckland. We were hit with piece of legislation after piece of legislation as they, first of all, we had the Royal Commission and 26% of all the submissions that they received about a proposed amalgamation that came from the Hauraki Gulf. Yeah, we organised very hard around it. We set up a postcard campaign, templates, workshops. Yeah, and what that meant was that the Royal Commission came to Waiheke to hear the submissions, and they came to Piritahi Marae, actually. And it was fantastic. We were actually wanting more local decision-making, not less. And the waste contract was used as a really good example of how council can undermine community efforts and undermine a community's economic abilities, because when we lost that contract, we lost 13 jobs. We lost, you know, the local diesel mechanic lost business because he was no longer servicing the local company's machinery because Trans Pacific have their own mechanics and engineers, etc. So we lost all that, and that was highlighted in the Royal Commission's report.
Yeah, and it's almost New Zealand in microcosm, isn't it? To the extent that we lose local community initiatives, regional development and so on. There's value in amalgamation and growing bigger, but I also think that we've swung a bit far, I think, often. We've swung away from a degree of local self-sufficiency, or at least maintaining enough infrastructure and economic activity to support the social and indeed the environmental benefits that can flow from that.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, a classic example on Waiheke with post-amalgamation is we've now got the Transport Agency, which is a council-controlled organisation, which isn't really accountable to certainly local community. Yeah. On Waiheke, they've got this, you know, I don't know where their plans are developed, but in terms of, you know, remediation for roads, what they've been doing is they've been curbing and channeling the roads, which, you know, that looks really nice in Ponsonby. But on Waiheke, what that does is it speeds up the water, and we don't have a drain system. We don't have reticulated water or waste water. So what happens is that it speeds up the flow of water into the sea. And, you know, what you get is increased sedimentation, increased runoff. And what we had before were swales or ditches with lots of plant life in them.
So the water has much more time to be filtered. It slows down the entry into the water body.
Yeah. And what we're noticing is that is the siltation in our bays and beaches as a result. And that's, you know, it's just crazy stuff, but that's what we've got post-amalgamation. And trying to stop them is a huge drama. You know, we've had people throw themselves in front of diggers to do it.
Goodness, yeah. It's very much, to me, it's a symptom of one-size-fits-all mentality.
Yeah.
So as you say, yes, in dense urban environments, you need that sort of infrastructure to carry water away, take it somewhere it can be treated if necessary, but you have got that luxury of space on Waikiki, haven't you? And the environment is such that you don't want to hasten up natural processes like water finding its way to the sea necessarily.
That's right. We've actually got our own, in the part of the regular, you know, the regulatory plan, we've actually got restrictions on street lighting, for example, and in order to preserve our way of life, and in order for us to be able to see the stars. So, you know, it's and we got that because people on Waiheke made a big deal about it.
It's all about organising, isn't it?
It is about organising, but it's also holding politicians to account, or if you are a politician, making sure that you listen to people and take those on board. I didn't know until it happened to me when I was a councillor that was how things worked, that, you know, I'd never considered streetlights. I just knew we didn't have many.
yes. Careful what you wish for sometimes, isn't it? It's too much of a good thing, yeah. So you then made the big step, and it is a big step, as we both know well, from local to central government. What was the decision point for that? Did you go seriously after to become an MP?
Oh, there were a couple of things really. In 2008, so the 2008 election, I stood for Auckland Central, but I was kind of a ring-in. So I didn't go through the list ranking process or anything like that. But because I was a city councillor and had a bit of profile in Auckland Central, I was selected as the candidate for Auckland Central after the person who had been originally selected stepped down for personal reasons. And it was a great campaign. It really was. It was it was a one-tick campaign, but I got quite a large personal vote, which wasn't actually about me. It was about the fact that the electorate was sick of the Labor Party member who'd been there, and the National Party MP, Nikki Kaye, actually won the seat. And she replaced Labor's Judith Tizard. Anyway, I was quite happy being a city councillor, but after the amalgamation in the super city, I stood for the Waiheke Local Board, which was because I saw that we had the potential to become a lot more proactive in describing and you know, providing services from council for our community, and so I was quite passionate about it. I was elected to Waiheke Local Board in 2010, but the woman who I had replaced as the city councillor was also elected, and three other fairly right-wing candidates were also elected. So I wasn't able to become the chair, and this caused some great distress on the island, I have to say. It was more about the way the board had handled
the process
it.
Than the outcome necessarily.
Yeah. And if I had been made the chair, I would definitely have stayed in local government politics. But the other thing that happened was that I was kind of shut out of a lot of the decision making, and was determined not to be negative or critical and to work with the board, but I was becoming increasingly isolated. So that I just figured, well, I've got a chance to step up.
Yes.
And so I stood for selection for the list ranking for the Green parties, and came in at number 11, which was great. We did a fantastic campaign, and I had lots of energy for the campaign because, honestly, the local board stuff was, it was fairly dire at times.
Yeah. So. It wasn't giving you anything to get your teeth into, obviously.
No.
And I must say, well, there's been a a silver lining to that cloud, obviously.
Yeah, it has actually. And I mean, I was accused actually it was unpleasant, but I have been accused a couple of times from people in my community about breaking a contract with them that they elected me as a local board member. But most of them could actually see that I wasn't able to be as effective as I'd liked. And that's certainly not the case as being an MP. You get to get stuck in.
You certainly do. Yeah, I think that's occasionally levelled at people who make that transition from local body to central government. And I think on occasion you see people who are simply using local body as a stepping stone, but I think for you and many others, there was a genuine commitment to local government. You did your time there and then have moved into another realm where you can apply your energies and attempt to achieve some stuff, yeah.
And serve my community this way, I guess.
Absolutely, yes. So what's keeping you busy now? What are some of the current issues for you in your portfolio areas?
Well, I've got my portfolio areas are industrial relations, and I've already touched on some of the things that are happening there.
Sure.
I've also got state services, which that kind of aligns with industrial relations because of the cuts that are going on there. Mm. Something like over 5,000 cuts, over 5,000 jobs lost from the state service sector in the last 3 years.
As many as that?
Yeah.
Goodness.
And more. And there's more of an emphasis on contracting, contracting out, but also getting consultants in. So the latest scandal is Inland Revenue Department spending $7 million getting some consultants in to transform the department, which has yet to be seen how that will play out. But, you know, there's been job losses along the way as well. So that's state services. I've also got the community and voluntary sector. And what we're seeing there is as the government cuts the public service, the community and voluntary sector are often picking up the pieces and providing the services that used to be provided by the state. Sometimes that can work, but usually what happens is that they're underfunded. And that's what we're hearing right across the country from community organisations, that it's a real struggle to keep the contracts that they've got with the government, to keep them at the same level. But there's a real push for them to provide more for less.
It's difficult, isn't it? Because a lot of us often advocate for community provision of services, particularly social services, but it's got to be in the context of appropriate funding support to enable that to happen.
Yeah.
And unfortunately, we seem to end up with the worst of both worlds on occasion.
Yeah, we do. Although the Whana Ora program has meant that some iwi and community services do get better funded than others, but it sets up this sort of unequal playing field, and it's like favouritism. So it's a bit of a mess, really. There's a lot of things that we could be doing to make things easier for community organisations. One is funding them better, but two is maintaining a level or a relationship between them and the state that's based on trust rather than on really, really grim reporting mechanisms.
What I often hear too is the term of the support. If people are only being funded a year at a time, it's kind of hard to make long-term plans and to develop strategies that are going to work. And community work, it's all about long-term, isn't it? You're seldom interested in 6, 9, 12-month periods alone.
Yeah, you've actually got to invest years, and it's got to be secure. But we're seeing more and more short-term contracts coming through. I've also got gambling. And that's been a fun industry. Yes. Oh, my goodness, it's so filthy. Not just the casino and the pokey for convention centre deal, but also pubs and clubs and numerous rorts that go on with the distribution of money to community groups.
Sure. Yes, you have managed to get a little media in just recent times about that, I think. So good on you. And
I'll be doing more.
I'm sure you will. Unfortunately, we do have to wrap up for today on this conversation, but anybody listening will be pleased to know that one reason we introduced Denise today is in future she may on occasion host this show, having been a guest on it now. So we look forward to that in time. And again, thank you, Denise, for coming in. It's been really interesting. Kia ora.
Aotearoa's most populous city could also be its greenest city. Explore ideas for a green Auckland every Monday at 9:05 a.m. or anytime online at planetaudio.org.nz/greenAuckland.